Thank you, Daniel. And if you wait long enough, you'll get to hear him again at the end of the services. We'll have a closing hymn, and he'll be playing again then. Well, this is a very, very important day. There's some very powerful messages connected with it. Very important knowledge that is often downplayed when people discuss theology or religion or ethics or these issues. A factor that is not enough is understood. There's an awful lot really to this day. It's hard to know just what to do when you have just one message to give. I would like to say that I'm not going to necessarily rebuild everything that you already know or should know or could find out. So let me just tell you, just in summary. Rather than summarize, first let me go to a verse. I want to go to Matthew, the ninth chapter. Matthew, the ninth chapter in the New Testament. And I want to go to verse 14. When Christ came along as a teacher in the first century, he was not your standard sort of teacher. So some people had to understand the reality that, in fact, this is how God would do it. You want to know how would God do it? This is the answer. But not everybody understood that initially. But in Matthew 9 and verse 14, then the disciples of John came to him saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the friends of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast." So Christ said, there's going to come a time when people are going to be very well aware of the need to draw closer to God, because I'm not going to be here. And then they are going to fast. Well, since Christians are going to be fasting, what better time for Christians to be fasting than a commanded fast in the Bible, a biblical fast commanded in the Bible? What better time to do it than the Day of Atonement? And yet, this is considered by everybody, as you know, a Jewish fast, and not that all that many Christians participate. But obviously, I'm contending that they should, and in fact, many of us are. But I want to just now cover a few things without necessarily turning there. In Leviticus 23, we see this day is commanded as a day of atonement, a day of afflicting the souls. Afflicting the souls is defined in the Bible in Psalm 35, verse 13. Talks about humbling your soul with fasting or afflicting your soul if you look up the original Hebrew. And then you go to Isaiah 58:3, you find that fasting and affliction of the soul are parallels. So we're to afflict our souls. In Leviticus 23, this day is commanded. It's also referred to again in Numbers 29. It's called, we know in Acts 27, verse 9, there's a reference to the fast. And a lot of people do know about this day, even if they don't keep it. For example, George and Laura Bush, they sent out a very nice little greeting, wishing those who were fasting to have a very enriching fast. Words to that effect, you could look it up. So many people are aware. I was telling my wife earlier, telling Linda, that normally on the Day of Atonement in earlier years, the stock market normally wasn't all that active because of the Day of Atonement. Now, however, there's so many people that are involved in the market that I don't know what the volume will be, but it may not be that much less than usual because just so many people are involved. Unfortunately, as we know, it hasn't been doing that well lately. But the Day of Atonement is a known quantity by many. As I said, it is a day of fasting. And it is a day which is connected to liberation. It's a time when the slate is wiped clean, in effect, when the nation came together, rituals were performed that renewed the relationship between Israel and its God, between husband and wife, if you want to look at it that way. It was a renewal of the relationship. It was a time to reflect on what has gone wrong, to resolve to do better, and to renew the relationship. And it was a time of liberation in that sense. Your guilt is removed. You can look forward to another year. And in Leviticus 25, on the 50th year, it was on the Day of Atonement. I will turn there. It was on the Day of Atonement that the great shofar was blown, which signaled that people could return to their own inheritance and have a new start in life. So it was a great time of liberation. I often refer to this movie, The Ten Commandments, and that's how the movie ended, with Charlton Heston reciting this verse. In Leviticus, which is on our Liberty Bell, by the way, as you know, on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. In Leviticus 25, verse 9, well, I'll start in the 8th verse. And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. This verse had an influence even on the Bahama Islands. They have their Independence Day on July 10th because that's the 10th day of their 7th month. Of course, on the sacred calendar, this is the 10th day of the 7th month. Verse 10, and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. So the Day of Atonement, at least in that 50th year, so every, twice a century, you could say, virtually, the Day of Atonement is a picture of the time of universal freedom. And that is a lot of what the message of this day is all about. I'd like to go to Hebrews, the 4th chapter. Now, I'm going to refer to Leviticus 16, because all the very, very important rituals of this day are shown there. And this, some years I read from it and talk about it. This year I'm not. At least I don't plan to, but as the Spirit moves through me, I could go there. But this year I'm not planning to cover in detail that chapter. But Leviticus 16 gives the rituals of this day. And it was a very solemn time. And I will say one thing about those rituals. They were very serious. And the Jews in their history record that when the high priest entered the Holy of Holies that day, which was the only time of year he did, And also among the Jews, the only time of the year he ever pronounced God's personal name, Yud Hey Vav Hey Y H W H, which perhaps was pronounced Yahweh, although we don't exactly know. But anyway, Jews don't pronounce that now, at least religious Jews don't. But once a year, the high priest would go in and pronounce the name in the Holy of Holies and do the rituals there. But when he went in, according to tradition, he had a rope tied around his waist so he could be dragged out of there should he die, because there was the possibility if he were unfit, he would die in there and he would have to be dragged out because nobody else would dare go in after him. And so actually he went in there with a rope around his waist, according to Jewish tradition, and that's how serious the matter was. Well, when the high priest came out of there alive, the community assumed things had gone well. And the rituals had been done, atonement had been made, the new year can begin. And it was very tense and very serious and very sober up until the time the high priest walked out of that Holy of Holies. But once he walked out, it was just a time of tremendous joy. And the high priest became a tremendous hero. And now, by the way, I can tie in with my story that I told earlier, because on the Day of Atonement, the eligible women would dance in front of the single men, and so it was a time when I guess men began making their choice. Women began thinking about those issues. And I suppose that Festival of Tabernacles coming up afterwards would have been a time to pursue the matter further. Now that we know we like each other, let's spend time during the festival coming up. But that's how exciting, that's how, what a difference it was. It was so sober before, and afterwards you had these eligible maidens dancing around. It was such a change of pace, because they were so thrilled that the high priest had done everything he had to do, had come out alive and well. And the high priest was the hero of the day. Well, where I'm going with this. The Day of Atonement pictures Jesus Christ as our high priest. And the book of Hebrews has a lot to say about that. So if you're looking for material to study, the book of Hebrews is a good place to go. Traditionally in synagogues, by the way, you might have noticed that Leviticus 18 is not far from Leviticus 16. You ever notice that? And Leviticus 18 is read by Jews on this day because that talks about sexual purity and among other issues. But the main one there is that. And it talks about maintaining high standards in that area. And so this is a Day of Atonement. It's a day of cleansing spiritually. And the Jews read Leviticus 18. They also read the book of Jonah, which has a lot of lessons that relate to this day. And that's something you might want to consider if you're looking for material relating to the theme of the day, is to read the book of Jonah. But as I said, in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews is really related to this day because it talks about Christ as our high priest. And I want to go to the fourth chapter of the book of Hebrews. And he says, and their author says in Hebrews 4:14, seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, you know, not a human being who lives and dies and he has to do, you know, he has to make sacrifices for himself because he's got flaws. We don't have a flawed high priest. We have a perfect high priest. We have an eternal high priest. And we have an all-powerful high priest. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our commission. I'm sorry, our confession. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. So Christ lived a normal human life with its ups and downs, but he didn't sin during that time. When Christ was here, he had probably days when he was uncomfortable and, you know, he might have made a mistake when he was working with his father, maybe hurt himself at times and so on. He had all of that. You know, but he was, you know, unless he was supernaturally protected, that's possible. But he had those possibilities to occur, and yet he was without sin. But he understands, you know. But you can't argue with him. Well, you don't know what it's like. Yes, I do, and not only that, but you know what he went through at the end of his life, how his life ended, before his resurrection, in a horrific way beyond description. So he obviously understands suffering in that sense. Not that he didn't need that, but you can at least show he can at least. You know, he can talk about that with us. Not that he had to do it, but he did do it. And in one sense, because of God's plan, in fact, it did have to happen. You know, the death was required because of sin. And in verse 15, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace. We can come boldly because of what Christ has achieved. His ministry causes us to actually come before God and make requests. Here we're talking to the master of the universe who's been around forever, and yet we can actually make requests and expect an answer. We can expect a positive answer. Now, if it's not good for us, he might say no, but we can at least expect, you know, hope for a positive answer because we can come in Jesus' name as we understand and from other verses. And here in verse 16 it says, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Now that's a very important message in this day, but the rest of my talk, or much of it, is going to have to do with another side of the story. Now, unfortunately, there is an evil force in the world, and a lot of secular authorities, even a lot of religious people, don't want to have to deal with that. It's a reality that is very unpleasant, and people don't want to deal with it. But if you really think about it, if you study human behavior, if you study how people have behaved, I don't know how you could explain the kind of things that have happened if there isn't some influence, some negative influence here, some force for evil. Just the sheer horror of what has happened, how many people have been tortured, how much evil has occurred in so many perverse ways, and some people seem to delight in it even. And you know all these stories. I don't have to go into them because, you know, you could spend too much time actually delving into that. What we used to call man's inhumanity to man, how human beings have treated other human beings. It is incredible. And even as I speak, it's going on in so many ways. It's because there, in fact, is an evil force in the world. And God is going to remove that. He's going to eventually put it away and remove it. And we fast on this day. Being very sober and serious, understanding that the time coming when we're going to understand the source of that wickedness and it will be put away. And we're going to have a very different world at that time, a world unlike the world that we have known or our ancestors have known, a world without that negative influence, that evil, that wicked influence. I'd like to go to Revelation, the 12th chapter. There is an evil being. There is a wicked being in the world, a wicked spirit being. Although people want to make light of it, at the end of the month there's going to be a holiday where people will make light of it. Or, unfortunately, some are fascinated with it, and that's perverse in its way. You know, let's not get fascinated with it. Let's not spend a lot of time dealing with it. There's information we need to know from the Bible, but we don't need to become, whatever you want to call it, occultists or something. We don't have to just get wrapped up in it. Nor should we analyze irrational behavior, because irrational behavior, by definition, is irrational. So why should you, you know, if it's only so far you could evaluate irrational behavior, and then you finally have to say, hey, that's nuts. That's irrational. And irrational behavior also is self-destructive. And you can certainly see self-destructive behavior. Sometimes it's subtle. Some people destroy themselves little by little with certain very bad habits, and little by little it's self-destructive. Sometimes self-destruction can be, you know, rather immediate. But let's not wallow in that, because God is a God of life, and God is a God who wants us to live forever. In Revelation in chapter 12 and verse 9, so the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan. Diablos, the Greek word for devil, means slanderer. That's what he is. And Satan, the Hebrew, ha-satan, means the adversary. That's the Hebrew term. Who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So you see, the world is in a state of deception. Doesn't mean that we don't know certain things. You know, people know certain physical things. I mean, today I'm webcasting. How can that be, right? How are you hearing me and all that? So obviously people know a lot and can do a lot. But at the same time, in a spiritual sense, the world is deceived. We are not following God's word as we should. Our civilization is not solidly grounded on the scripture. It isn't. Even those that claim they are really are not. They are in a distorted sort of way. And so all of us, in one way or another, all nations, are in one way or another deceived. That is the spiritual state of the world, in spite of how technologically advanced we might be. You know, many Orthodox Jews often go back to the example, and not to pick on any one country, but they go back to the example of Nazi Germany. The Germans were the best educated and most advanced technological people in Europe. But you saw what happened. They followed Hitler. You know, millions of them, Sieg Heil, millions of them. What happened to all their education? How could they follow a man like that? And how could they do the things that he ordered them to do? And those were really highly educated people. So knowing how to drive a car or fly a plane or explode an atomic bomb, that's not enough. There's spiritual knowledge that we need. And as you see here, and as you all know, you know, the world is deceived. And Satan and his demons, because there are demons, there are fallen angels. They are a reality. They have influenced human civilization in a negative way. Now, obviously, there's a positive side, too. You know, their God is here. His angels are here. You know, we have the positive and the negative. But this is the choice that we each have to make. You know, we have to overcome evil, you know, and we have to do good. We have to understand the difference between right and wrong and do what's right. That's what, you know, how character is built. Well, now, if a person is willing to admit that evil exists, you know, that there is a Satan, that there are demons. If a person is willing to admit that, you know, a question that could be asked or that should be asked is, did God create a devil? And the answer, of course, is no. It wasn't his plan A. It wasn't his intent originally that this be the case. He did allow for it, but it was not his, well, you know, desire that it happened that way. But he did allow for it because he did create a being with free moral agency who could make the wrong decision and did. And evidently, once Satan and his demons made that decision, it became irrevocable. That is not the same for human beings, fortunately. Human beings are capable of making the wrong decision, repenting, and getting back on track, you know, with God's help. Evidently, the spirit world, that is not the case. You know, the angels are fixed in their character. Two-thirds of them are following God directly. One-third of them are following Satan, according to biblical information. You know, you can put all the data together, and I don't have time to do all that at this point. But let's go to Isaiah, the 14th chapter. Isaiah, the 14th chapter. I want to just cover some basic ground. But, you know, if I don't cover basic ground every once in a while, I'm afraid things will just slip away or they'll become garbled. Besides that, covering basic ground gives people a chance to think it over, ask questions, and therefore we can refine our understanding. So we don't want to just ignore the basics. Now, if you look at Isaiah 14, you see that God is talking about a powerful nation that has persecuted his people, a powerful ruler. This ruler is now coming to an end. God is going to deal with him. But then it seems to go from that to a much greater adversary, to the power behind the throne, you might say. Now, to get an understanding, I want to give credit to a teacher for whom I worked years ago. He ran the college when I was there in the 70s, Ron Dart. When he ran the college, he spoke a lot in those days, and he talked about prophecy as like a dream. Now, the prophets were given visions, and in some cases dreams, and so prophecy is very poetic and very symbolic. But if you think about a dream, all of you have dreamed. And when you dream, sometimes your dreams tend to fade in and out, and people become other people. And sometimes it has to do with theme. You know, maybe there's a person that you're thinking about, and then he becomes another person because you had problems with that other person, too, of a similar nature. And you kind of sometimes it becomes a composite. You know, there's a composite person. Or sometimes an episode, you know, several episodes combined together, or anachronistic things happen. You're in a situation, and somebody maybe who has already died is back there in the situation, even though he shouldn't be, you know, that sort of thing. I think we've all been through that. And prophecy is like that. It's a vision. And so there's some types and antitypes, and they flow in and out. And so it does take a certain amount of discernment to understand prophecy. And one has to be careful with prophecy to try to understand. One needs to be in a proper frame of mind and look to God for the understanding. And basically, what would that mean? That would mean that the Bible itself ought to be used as the first tool to understand any portion of it. We have a collection here, which is a canon. Some made the canon and some didn't. Some material made the cut, you could say, and some didn't. So the material that is in here because it conforms to the rest of the material, and therefore, to understand one part of the Bible, you use the rest. And let, as much as possible, let the Bible interpret the Bible. So if a symbol is used and not explained, you know, read on and see if it's explained later in the book, earlier in the book, or in another book. And before I go to Isaiah 14, I know you've all turned there, but I'm going to make you turn back or turn forward to the 2 Peter. And I don't know how many of you have even enough energy to flip a page anymore. Anyway, 2 Peter, the first chapter. Here's what he says towards the end of his life as he writes his second epistle. He says, knowing this first, that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation. Just don't go off on your own and think that you're going to become some kind of prophecy buff or whatever. For prophecy never came by the will of man, but holy men of God spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. God inspired the prophecy. So before you go off, you know, half-cocked spiritually, as it were, you know, let's be well armed spiritually. Let's have the data in the Bible. So let's take a look at Isaiah 14 with that in mind. In Isaiah 14, as I said, God is judging this ruler, but then he does seem to move up into the ruler who rules over the other rulers. Verse 12 of Isaiah 14. How are you fallen from heaven, Hillel ben Shachar? So who is this Hillel ben Shachar? Well, Shachar, if you know Hebrew, is the dawn, the very early part of the morning when it's still dark. The Jews call their morning service Shacharit. And one of the great Israeli newspapers is HaShachar, or used to be. I'm not sure there was a paper called HaShachar. I'm not sure it's there anymore. But anyway, Shachar is, Ben Shachar is called Son of the Morning, or the Morning Star, perhaps referring to Venus, which was very prominent in ancient times as the Morning Star. And he calls him Hillel, which has to do with brightness. So he calls him, you know, the bright one. And so trying to come up with some way of translating this, the standard translation gave him a name, and they called him Lucifer or Light Bearer in Latin. And in a way, if you study what scholars say about these terms, Hillel ben Shachar, these are, in effect, mythological terms. These are names for heroic, for figures that were a folklore of the time. It's like I compare somebody to Superman. You know, you were Superman. You were, whoever the great stars would be. You know, who are some of the great stars that don't ever get hurt or are very, very great? I'm thinking, I was thinking Indiana Jones, but he can get hurt. But how about some of these superheroes? You know, he's comparing him to them, and because just in those days too, there were popular figures that everybody knew about. Just as there are now. And so he's referring to the popular culture of that day. He's saying, you were like Superman. You were like these great heroes, great superheroes. That's what you were like, but that's not what you are now, because you are now in a different state. You know, you have corrupted yourself. You have become wicked, and you are going to therefore be punished. You know, he says, how are you fallen? He fell. He was in heaven with God. He was an angelic being, a very great one, and he fell. How are you cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations? Now, why did this happen? Because this being lusted for power, got very vain, very self-centered, and decided he ought to be God. You know the old story about this couple that split up over religious differences. You know, she thought he was God and he disagreed. That's in effect what we have here. Here's somebody who wants to be, you know, it's not good enough to be right with God, to be one of three angels, archangels with him, with Michael and Gabriel, but you want to be top. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. This refers to the common concept in those days that the mountain of the north was in the pagan knowledge of those days. You know, there was a northern mountain where the gods were, and so it probably just came into common language. Like we use language now that is just based on you know, folklore. It doesn't mean that it's literally true, but it's just idioms or languages that we use. For example, we talk about panic. I think if you go back to the term panic, there may be I guess that word is all right. I think I was thinking of the god Pan, but I think panic does not come from that. Maybe it does, but I don't think so. But there are words we use all the time that are reflections of ideas that are wrong, but we just use the words. And so this is a way of poetically talking about, you know, going to heaven, going to the north. In those days, heaven was thought of as the place of the north. You know, going to heaven is going north. So you're going, you know, you want to go north. You want to go to heaven. You want to be on top. Now, God had given those beings administration over the earth. They were to guide the creation here and eventually guide human beings. But they didn't want that job, or they rebelled against it, and they began to, in effect, work against human beings. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. This is what Satan thought. And he convinced a third of the angels to follow him and rebel against God, and in effect decide we want another God. You know, we don't want this God. We want a new one. Amazing, but did manage to do that. It convinced a third of them. So they are now demonic. They are perverse. They're irrational. So don't spend a lot of time trying to analyze their behavior. It's pointless. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, you know, to the abode of the dead. The Greek term is Hades. That's where you're going, down, 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 and out, to the lowest depths of the pit. So this is very poetic language. I hope I haven't upset any of you in talking about there's a lot of poetic language here, but he's talking in the language of the literature of the day to get a point across. And this is, you know, it's very beautifully written from a literary point of view, but the point is that here's a being who was right near the very highest, who's going to go down to the very, very lowest because of sin, because this being is now consumed in sin and has brought about more horror than anyone can ever imagine. And there's no way to even talk about all the horrors of all these thousands of years, all the suffering that has come about because of Satan and his demons. Now, there's another verse in Ezekiel 28. I mean, the good news is that it doesn't go on forever. God does put a stop to it. This power will end. And that's what this day pictures, a time when it ends. And that's what's a wonderful truth, to know that the negative impulses that many of us have won't be there anymore. Now, that doesn't mean people still won't have to have a certain amount of character, because you could be lazy. You could just not want to put out forth effort, or you might be overly concerned with yourself. It can happen just naturally. But you won't have the same negative side that we have now, what we call human nature. It won't be that way. You won't have that downward pull if you're in that age. Now, frankly, I hope the people I'm talking to now will actually be spirit at that time. And that'll be a whole other dimension. But the people of that new age will be able to have a positive reinforcement. And so often there's a negative reinforcement. So often we're tempted to do the wrong thing. You know, it's really interesting. I wasn't even going to talk about this, but the other night I was in the computer lab where I teach, and it's amazing. Talk about technology, what you can do. You put on these earphones and you get on the computer, and these doors open up, and you walk through these doors, and there's all these English exercises to do. And in one of the English exercises, there's a note that a boss sends to his secretary, and he says, if anybody asks for me, make up an excuse. You know, in other words, lie. And I'm thinking, you know, well, what are you going to do? Lose your job? Maybe you're going to, maybe you really need that money. You know, maybe you got five children and one of them needs braces, and you can go on with the scenario. And maybe the work is tough and it's a good job and you're making a lot of money, and the boss says, lie for me. What are you going to do? I mean, this is constant in the world we live in today. You know, and I was just thinking this morning about the fact that when I was a young man, or not even a young man, before that, when I was a child, I had some friends that were pretty religious. And there were times when I began to stray, and they began to say, how could you, Mark? You know, how could you do that? You know, and you know, for example, one year I was under a lot of pressure, and I thought, well, maybe I should go to school on Sukkot. You know, I at least toyed with the idea. I was a small child. You know, because you have to understand, my immediate family was not religious. I had a religious uncle, but he didn't live there. He was in New Jersey. So my immediate family wasn't all that religious. So I was thinking, well, you know, I'm under a lot of pressure. Maybe I should go to school on the Feast of Tabernacles. And my friend said, what? How could you? You know, and so on. And so that peer pressure convinced me. No, of course. You know, I never had that again. That only happened once in my life when I was, I don't know, 10 years old or something. It never happened again. But I'm saying, you know, that's a positive peer pressure. And I'm thinking now, what's it like now? You know, where's our positive peer pressure now? Who's telling us, keep the feast, make sure you fast on Thursday, make sure that you don't go to work on Tuesday when it's the first day of the feast? You know, who's telling us that? I'm telling you that. You know, but, you know, are your friends telling you that? Your relatives telling you that? So it's just sad. But in the future, there'll be that positive peer pressure. People are going to be wanting to do the right thing. So we'll be encouraged to do the right thing. Anyway, let's go to Ezekiel 28. Now notice, in Ezekiel 28, you had the prince of Tyre. And, okay, he was a powerful ruler of a city, state, Tyre, which is in what is today Lebanon. But then you keep going, and you come to the king of Tyre. And this is more. This is the power behind the throne. And in Ezekiel 28, you come to verse 11, to the king of Tyre. Moreover, the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus says the Lord Eternal, You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. So you know the tradition of the muses. There's something to that. There's probably a spirit that influences artistic ability, you know. And you know, that it can be either used or misused. Artistic ability can be used or misused. Satan and his demons have musical ability, and music can be misused. You know, as I've talked about the Nazis before, I'm sure they had some very rousing songs to sing as they marched out invading Poland in, you know, September of 1939. There are probably some very inspiring tunes that they sang to get all riled up to go do it. You know, and so I'm saying, music can have its positive and negative side. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. Now, it wouldn't seem, except in a poetic way, that he'd be talking to the Prince of Tyre in this way. In a poetic way, he could be. But if you read it closely, it seems to be here where he's talking about that spirit being that is the power behind the throne. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created, till iniquity was found in you. So God did not create the devil. He became that way because he made that decision. He became sinful. So you see, free moral agency is there. And ultimately, each of us is accountable for the decisions that we make. Now, in the future, without that influence, people are going to have a clear head and be able to really make a better decision. And even then, maybe some will falter. I hope not. But at least they'll be making the decision clearly without this outside influence. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within. Not only trading, but also gossip and rumor, you know, slander, as you know from the Greek. And so this word trading could also refer to gossip. So it's talking here about, first of all, being, what's the word, cupidity, avarice, you know, greed, more, right? And beyond that, more, attacking other people, using words as weapons to undermine others and undermine the respect for them and undermine the other's authority and their reputations. You became filled with violence within. So hatred of others leads to violence against others. And you sinned. Therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. He was put out. He wasn't there anymore. And from there, that point on, it might, you know, it's ambiguous as to, you know, whether it's talking more about the devil or talking more about that king. So I'll leave it there. But you see that these verses I've read do seem to be verses more about not only about a human ruler, but beyond that, about this spirit ruler, if you want to use that term, this demonic ruler, Satan, who is king over these demons, and the influence that he has had over history, over human civilization, this negative influence. It begins, of course, in the Garden of Eden, and you know he's symbolized by a serpent, as you know from Revelation 12. He's symbolized by a serpent in the Garden of Eden. He uses a serpent to communicate. You know, the serpent becomes a symbol of Satan in certain ways. You know, certain characteristics of a serpent. You know, that obviously a serpent is poisonous, and at least some are. And so they have that relationship to people, that people are not comfortable around them. Nor should we be comfortable around wickedness. We should, you know, flee from it, not want to be a part of it. You know, I wasn't going to necessarily turn to this verse, but it comes to mind now. In Psalm 97, it says, verse 10, you who love the eternal, hate evil. You know, evil really leads to no good consequence, you know. So we should hate evil, not people, but evil. Hate evil. You who love the eternal, hate evil. He preserves the souls of the saints. He delivers them out of the hand of the wicked. Ultimately, we are delivered, and this day pictures that deliverance. So this gives us some background as to, in effect, the origin of Satan. And Satan can only go as far as God allows him to go. So, you know, the world is not totally destroyed. If you resist the devil, he will flee. And the book of Job shows that Satan can have access to God if he allows it. And God can allow Satan a certain leeway, but he can't prevent him from doing what God doesn't want him to do. Let's go to the book of James. What you're hearing is like a whole semester, you know, in a way, just, you know, narrowed down to one sermon. But I know some of you know where to turn to in the Bible. I refer to a lot of different places you can turn to and study later. The book of Job, Genesis 3. I'm going to go to James. I'm going to go to the fourth chapter there. Before I do that, though, since we are in the general epistles, I want to go back to Peter. You know, it's just a few more pages, and I know you're really wearing out now, but you know, hang in there. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. Now, I don't want to be an overly serious sort of person, because you know, life should be enjoyed. Life has challenges, and it has challenges enough without you coming to Sabbath services and having to, you know, the minister berate you and make you feel miserable. I mean, there's enough trouble in life without the minister being an additional burden to you. You know, so obviously a minister should be positive, and God's message is positive, obviously. We call it the gospel, good news. But at the same time, a day like this is a sober day, because it's not fun to go without food, at least not for me, not for most people. You know, so it causes you to be a bit sober and to think about the fact that there are serious issues in life to deal with. And we want to make sure that we are not allowing ourselves to dwell on negative thoughts, you know, to focus on that. You know, in other words, if there's a certain kind of music that puts you in a negative frame of mind, don't listen to it. If there's stuff that you read that has a bad effect on you, read something else. Don't read it. You know, don't fill your mind with stuff that's negative, that causes you to go in negative directions. You have that kind of control. You can make choices. We make choices all the time. I remember when one fellow came over to our home, and he noticed that we have a tendency to mute commercials in my home. You know, when a commercial comes on, it seems like one of the children automatically hit the mute button. And this fellow is amazed. Well, why? Why are you amazed? That's what it's there for. You can mute something. You don't have to listen to that. You know? Some people just kind of go through life, and just everything works on them, and they don't seem to just stand up and be I'm going to decide what I'm going to do with my life. And they're just sort of drawn along. You know, the talking points are out there, whatever they may be, and they just spew them out. You know, we all know such people. In 1 Peter 5, it says, verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. You know, so there are the vulnerable ones that he can devour, but you don't have to be in that category. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. You know, everybody goes through these experiences in life that everybody else has to go through. Whatever, you know, growing up, you know, finding a job, finding a home, transportation, you know, you name it. Finding a mate, all of these things that we have to go through. You know, we all go through these things, and we have the Bible to guide us. We have access to God, as I said. Certainly Christians have access to God through Jesus Christ, so we have a leg up in that sense. So let's certainly take advantage of that. Let's pray, let's study, and let's try to be positive in what we do. I'd like to go now back to James. Very simple statement here in verse 4, I mean, in chapter James 4 and verse 7. He says, therefore, submit to God. Well, you know, that's one thing we're doing today. We wouldn't have chosen to do this. God says, afflict your souls. So we're doing it. Therefore, submit to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, we have an example of that from Jesus Christ himself, where Satan came to him and tempted him, and he resisted, and the devil had to flee. There's one section I want to turn to in that, or one account of that. You know, each author has his spin, if you don't mind my using that kind of term. I'm using it in a positive way. Each author has his emphasis that he placed on the account of the gospel writers. There are different audiences, different times when the books were written. Now, the book of Matthew was written early and to a Jewish audience. I'd like to go to Matthew 4. And there's a point I'm trying to make here. There's two points I'm trying to make. Verse 8 of Matthew 4. Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and all their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Well, Christ didn't dispute the fact that he could have done it. So you see that Satan is allowed leeway. So you have empires that rise and fall. And sometimes God allows Satan to influence world events to that degree. How did Hitler so suddenly rise and suddenly take all those countries? That seems to be virtually a supernatural matter. I know you could explain it maybe militarily, technologically, and all that, but it does seem amazing, too, in another sense, how he took over the country and how he so quickly came to power, but at the same time, within 12 years, he was gone. He came and he went rather quickly. Just he did terrible damage during that time. But Christ didn't necessarily argue, Jesus didn't argue with him as to whether he could do it. He just said, out! Then Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the eternal your God, and him only shall you serve. So that's the end of the story, you know. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him. I knew a woman who said to me she was getting all these various dreams and strange thoughts, and I said, well, we'll get rid of them. And she, you know, it was kind of interesting. She said she didn't want to. Well, if you don't want to, what can I say? I just hope that you don't destroy yourself in the process. I don't know what happened to her, but she was having all these, you know, wild, you know, ideas coming into her head. And I said, put them out, get rid of them, you know, resist it. You know, people want a sense of power sometimes, and so when these things begin to happen, they, you know, they're flattered by it. Oh wow, I can, you know, be psychic. I can know something more than somebody else. No. Why should you? You know, that's not, in the long run, it's, you know, you'll be miserable. A lot of things happen to people you don't want to know about, you know. So just put it out. Resist it. Don't get enamored of it. Don't get all fascinated by it and all involved in it. Find some other more positive way to spend your time. There's plenty of people that need help, plenty of things you can do, plenty of things to learn. I'd like to go to Revelation 20. Because I don't have time to do, of course, to cover the whole subject today, but the rituals of Leviticus 16 point us to Revelation 20 and how things finally wind up, and that's where I want to conclude. How does it all wind up? We see that God created an angelic being who went wrong, and demons under him. They were put in charge of the earth, And so we have our earth, the earth the way it is. War after war, trouble after trouble, disasters, hurricanes, you know, typhoons, tsunamis. You know, we have the world as we have it because they're right now in charge for the moment. God is ultimately in charge, but he has allowed this evil influence to be here and to affect even the nature of animals, the nature of people. You know, we have some power over that, obviously, but it's there. It can be resisted, though. I've shown you it can be resisted. The fact that you're here listening to me shows that it can be resisted. In Revelation 20, then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who was the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. Now, the Festival of Tabernacles that we're going to soon be celebrating pictures that time of 1,000 years without the devil. Peace, prosperity, positive reinforcement, as I've said. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Now, to save time, I won't read some of the other verses because very likely I'll be reading them later. And you've read them before, and hopefully you'll read them again. But it has to do with the fact that the saints will be resurrected and then will rule with Jesus Christ over a world that will become more and more prosperous, more and more peaceful, a more and more wonderful place to be, which we used to call the wonderful world tomorrow, and we had good reason for using that term. Now, however, at the end of that 1,000 years, Satan is released briefly because there's going to be one last opportunity, if you want to look at it that way. It is an opportunity for people to either say yay or nay, you know, for people to be deceived if they're going to allow themselves to be, and many will be, unfortunately, then. So don't underestimate the fact that the negative side is very powerful. You know, that's why I'm saying you shouldn't toy with it. You should stay close to God. Have your nose in the Bible. You know, because the other side is, you know, that force is a very powerful force. There's all kinds of ways you can deceive yourself. There's all kinds of vulnerabilities we have. It depends on the person, you know, what his particular vulnerability is. You know, maybe he wants more status. Maybe he wants more, you know, victory socially. You know, he wants to be thought of as, you know, Prince Charming, Don Juan, you know, or maybe he wants to be the next very rich person, you know, the next, you know, you name it, Donald Trump or whatever that name comes to mind because he has a lot of money, nothing against him, you know, but I mean, it just comes to mind. You want to be the next very wealthy person, Scrooge McDuck, you know, whatever it is. You know, so whatever your vulnerability is, you know, so, with God, we can resist all of that. So anyway, he's let out for briefly here in verse 8, and will go out to deceive the nations which are on the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. So evidently the rebellion starts in Northeast Asia, far away from Jerusalem, the headquarters, and maybe one of the arguments is, you know, why should Jerusalem be the headquarters? Why shouldn't it be, you know, Beijing? You know, China used to be called the Middle Kingdom. So, you know, maybe that's where this is speculation. But Gog and Magog is also, to a discerning, you know, a reader, symbolic of all of the nations that have any hostility to God. In other words, anywhere who are hostile to God are part of this Gog and Magog group. I can't go into the reason for that now, but in Hebrew symbolism, Gog and Magog stands for all of God's enemies around the world. And will go out to deceive the nations which are on the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. But what happens? They're dealt with very quickly. God so decisively deals with them that anybody who witnessing it would have no question, you know, who's in charge. God is in control. Now, before I go any further with that, I want to say one last thing. You know, I make it my business to stay out of politics because I believe it's something that a Christian should not be involved with. And I want to just let you know in Daniel 4 what the Bible says about the rising and falling of power. Now there's a lot in the Bible on that, but there's one verse that I wanted to read today, which is very sobering and terrifying, but it's there, it's in the book, and it's true, and we know it's true. We know examples of it. I'm in Daniel 4:17, at least I want to be. I keep looking and seeing Daniel 3. All right, Daniel 4, let's turn the page. Daniel 4. Now, we're in the middle of a vision here, but Daniel 4, this is a dream that's being interpreted. Daniel 4:17, this decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. So God is ultimately in charge. Gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. That's what it says. Some people who should never be in power are sometimes allowed to be there. The lowest. How do they get there? Well, there's ways and means that they have to get there. But, you know, after all, was Hitler a great person before he became what he became? He'd been a corporal in World War I. He'd been a paper hanger, I think. That's what I was told as a child, you know, and I haven't read a biography of him in a long time. You know, but how great a person was he? And then all of a sudden, you know, within a few years, he was running Germany. And I know I keep going back to that example, but there's other examples you could think about, pro and con, of people who seem to come out of nowhere and very quickly rise to power and then often just so quickly leave too. Just like in show business, the one hit wonder. You know, a guy, you know, makes a lot of money and then you never hear from him again. And that's true politically too. So we don't know what's going to happen at any given time, but sometimes people are put in charge who really shouldn't be there, but God has allowed it for whatever reason. Now I would say this too. There's a statement that you probably have heard, which is important to be aware of, that we tend to get the government we deserve. That culture tends to produce politics. You know, politics reflects the culture, and so the kind of people that run the country often reflect the overall culture of the country. And so, if you have a very corrupt society where people are being very deceptive, that's going to, you know, first of all, it's true that, as George Putnam used to say, who recently died, the fish stinks from the head. You know, it's true that the leadership can corrupt the society, but there's kind of a relationship back and forth. People come from the society to run it, you know, and so often they reflect the vices of the society as they rule it, but then also they can push it in further negative directions as well. I don't want to get into examples of that because then I'll, you know, if I cite one, somebody will say, what about on the other side? And, you know, I don't want to get into all that. So that's being said, but God is ultimately in charge. And the good news is that ultimately we're going to have perfect rulers. We're going to have Jesus Christ ruling and under him the saints. So eventually, you know, we'll have a perfect government in the future. And that's what we're talking about here. Well, then Satan comes and there's a brief period of deception, which is very quickly dealt with. We are now in verse 9 of Revelation 20. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone with the beast and false prophet. The italics, this word is in italics, are. It could also be were, and that would make more sense because people burn up when they're in fires. So if the beast and false prophet are thrown in fire, by now they're ashes by this point. So they were there, where the beast and false prophet were. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Well, who will be tormented? Spirit beings don't get burned. They don't get burned up. So they are tormented because he's lost. And he's powerless. So he is tormented. So why does it say they? Because, as I said, there are demons with him. So Satan is restrained as well as the demons, and they're tormented forever and ever because they are now weak, you know, completely weakened with no power at all. And all of their plans are gone, finished. God's plan is what is triumphant. And so if we keep on reading, we find that ultimately some people die and they're dead forever. It's the second death. You know, in other words, it's the death from which there is no return, because God is a God who resurrects. But after you make your decision permanently, you're dead forever. There's no resurrection from that. That's the second death. And others then, I live forever. Revelation 20, verse 14. Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. But I believe that nearly everybody will be in that book of life once they have a clear choice. Certainly the vast majority will. And verse 21, and so this is what this day then looks forward to. Because, you know, right now we don't enjoy not eating. But once we're spirit, we won't have to eat. So, one reason we fast is to remember that we're dependent now. We have to breathe, we have to drink water, we have to eat food, we have to rest. You know, but when we're spirit, we won't have to, we'll be, you know, free of any kind of limitations. We won't have to worry about how much sleep did we get last night or any of those kinds of things. How hot is it outside? How cold is it outside? You know, we don't have those kind of worries. Chapter 21. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. A whole new environment. And frankly, I would like to say this, just to sort of contribute it to the general fund. I believe that at this point in time, when there's a new heaven and a new earth, I believe that Satan and his demons will not exist anymore. That's my belief. And the traditional teaching in the Church of God was that they would just go on forever and ever, without any power, just always around, but not accomplishing a thing, just restrained forever. That is the common teaching. I frankly believe that once God's plan is completed, and we have a new heaven and new earth, they will go out of existence. What does that mean? I mean, God will put them out of existence. That's what I mean. He decides that. You know, I believe he'll put them out of existence. But not until then. Not until then. Now, you don't have to agree with that. And I understand that the tradition in the church is to believe that somehow they'll always be around, but just completely powerless and restrained. So, you know, that's my view. And if we want to discuss it, we can discuss it. We got plenty of time at the next festival to do it, 8 days, when we can discuss it. Anyway, chapter 21. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. You know, this is a side point, but, you know, when Jews finish the fast tonight, they will blow a shofar. And they will then say, L'shana haba abba Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. Well, what did they say in Jerusalem? In Jerusalem, they say, L'shana haba abba Yerushalayim habanuya, next year in the rebuilt Jerusalem, next year in the millennial Jerusalem. All right? So what we say, in effect, is, you know, next year or some, you know, whenever it is, but hope next year, but in the future anyway, the future will be in the new Jerusalem. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. So right now we're afflicting our souls, and we're uncomfortable. And if you're not uncomfortable now, you will be as the day goes on. But that is what we're picturing, a time when there'll be no discomfort, if you can imagine that. And we can only imagine that now. I can believe it intellectually. It's hard to wrap my mind around a time when, not my arm, but my mind, poetically, I'm speaking poetically, you know, wrap my mind around a time when I won't have discomfort at all. Nobody else will. Wow. But that is, I believe it firmly. But it's just hard to, in a way, wrap one's mind around it. But I know it's true. Then he who sat on the throne... And here it says, right? It tells me. Then he who sat on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. Yes, these words are true and faithful. So let's resist the evil one so that he'll flee from us. And I'll go back to James because there is another verse there I didn't continue to read. Let's go back to James 4. Draw near to God in James 4, 8. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. You know, during a fast, we can think about how we can do better in the year to come, and we can be more focused on the goal, which is the kingdom of God. And we can look forward, you know, to that time, pictured in Revelation 21. Let's go back to Revelation 21. If you don't mind, we'll finish there. Revelation 21, 6. And he said to me, It is done. You know, this day does picture that very important step in God's plan of the putting away of evil, the atonement, bringing people together and people together with Christ and people together, of course, with God the Father. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. You know, right now we're thirsting physically, but we should also be thirsting physically. We should want God's Spirit, and he will give it to us freely. Verse 7, He who overcomes shall inherit all things, all things. We're going to rule the universe with God. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. As we know elsewhere, his son or daughter. So this is a wonderful future that we have, you know, that this day pictures. So let's keep this day with that knowledge in mind. And I hope that what I've said today will help make it a more meaningful day to everybody. So have a wonderful Yom HaKippurim, this day of atonement. As it's called in Hebrew, Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement. And may I also add that we have the coming Festival of Tabernacles. We are, in effect, preparing ourselves, purifying ourselves to be in a right attitude for that 8 days when we can be feasting, but yet feasting in a right attitude, having a wonderful time, and yet, you know, remaining Christian while doing it. That will, of course, begin on Monday evening. And we will have a service here, not where I'm speaking from now, but in our festival location. And that will begin at 8 o'clock on Monday evening. We could webcast it. I guess we can webcast it, right, or no? We will webcast it if anybody wants to listen, but other, or you can then maybe download and hear it at another time. And as far as live services, some of you may conveniently be able to participate in live services that will be at 3 o'clock on the holy days and on the Sabbath, because that will be noon on the West Coast. The rest of the time, we're going to probably be meeting here, you know, most of those days at 10 a.m., and that will be kind of difficult on the West Coast. You'll be listening at 7 if you hear it live. Then we'll have a Friday night Bible study at 8, which will be 5 o'clock on the West Coast. Well, pardon me. More about that in the future. For now, let's go ahead and have a